This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello and welcome to Dialect Radio for Sunday, the 14th of March. This week we've got June Burrows, who runs the Peering Centre in Portland Square, and she's launching a week at the Bristol Cathedral to do with working together for positive change. There's also an ecological theme this week as we hear from Scottish ecology and land rights campaigner and academic Alistair McIntosh, who's widely credited with helping return the Island of Egg to the people, visited Bristol recently. Peter Bruce is here too, and local historian Barb Drummond discusses enclosure or the privatisation of the land with Dialect's Tony Gosling. And as ever, we hear some more Hedge Trimmings, our Wiltshire Country Life serial, read by the actor Malcolm Greaves. I'd like to start this week with saying hello to Jane Burrow. Hello.
Hello.
Now, you run the Peering Centre, which a lot of people might not have heard of. Tell me a little bit about what that is.
It's a social enterprise, community interest company, which is does trading to bring money in and then spends all that money on serving the wider community of Bristol, particularly disadvantaged, excluded and marginalised groups.
OK, so probably hence your location, which I think is just off Portland Square in St Paul's.
It's in Portland Square, yeah.
So how wide a catchment area is your do you sort of take in?
Well, it started really being quite local to St Paul's, and I think we concentrated on kind of getting to know people there. But it's now, it is literally around the whole city, and it's getting wider and wider. I think, you know, we reach out across the city to all sorts of different groups, and we work in different partnerships all over the place now. So,
okay. So how many other centres are there like that in Bristol now?
Like the Peering Centre, I don't think there's any centre that does that mixture of things in quite the way we do it. We're a professional conference facility, and we also do complementary therapy, and we also have education and learning. We do weddings and celebrations, and we do arts and culture community projects, and we do a lot of things outside. And I don't think there's any organisation that does that mixture of things in quite that way.
How have you found the recession? Because, for example, the Cumber Arts Centre off Stokes Croft had a lot of problems and nearly closed because of funding being withdrawn. Have you found the recession?
Well, because we're not 100% reliant on funding, we have bits of funding for projects like Refugee Week or a tent project that we're doing in September and things like that. I'm not sure that we haven't really noticed much difference in the recession. It's tight, but then it's always been tight. We've never had quite enough money.
So you're well disciplined.
So we've learnt as we go along how to manage frugally and kind of make ends meet somehow.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what's happening in the cathedral on the 27th of March. What's going to go? What's happening on that day?
All right. So it's Monday, the 22nd of March.
22nd of March.
Yeah, 22nd. It's a lunchtime event with about 50 organisations from around Bristol, looking at how we showcase what we're doing in Bristol to create prosperity and inclusion. So it's called Working Together for Positive Change. Mm-hmm. It's the beginning of a whole year of events, projects and getting together, which will finish in February 2011 with a big, big conference. It's all part of the European Year for Combating Poverty and Social Exclusion. And in the cathedral, we're hoping to get 400 or 500 people together to learn more about what works and best practice and the things that do work in order that we can look at how we do more of it for the people who still need it.
Is this is that meeting up with sort of state institutions like social services as well as charities and organisations, stuff like that?
We've certainly got some people from the council coming. I mean, it's not at all comprehensive. I mean, 50 organisations is a tiny, tiny percentage of the number of projects and things that are going on. We've tended not to go for the big nationals this time round. There are one or two there, but to go for more of the sort of grassroots, small projects to just try and showcase what's going on in smaller communities around the city. But some of them are national and some of them are big.
I mean, when they decided they're going to have a year for combating poverty and social exclusion, shouldn't they always be doing that? Doesn't that rather beg the question?
They are, but I think European years are quite useful. They kind of designate a year with a title. So last year was innovative and creative, or creativity and innovation. And the year before was intercultural dialogue, and next year is volunteers. And I think what we were feeling is, let's use that as an umbrella to just see what's going on in Bristol and try and work out what really works and how we do more of it. And to do that, we're doing this as part of the launch of the Bristol Partnership, because their vision for 2020 is a socially just, equal city and a place where citizens can really kind of do what they can do. Mm. And I think that means that what we're doing is saying, how does the issue of poverty and social exclusion, which is extraordinary in Bristol, we're per capita the richest city outside London in the UK, but we also have four neighbourhoods which are in the top 10% of deprivation in the UK.
And which areas are those?
I can't always remember them. I think Lawrence Weston, Witherwood and Hartcliffe, Knoll West area. I can't remember what the other two are off the top of my head. But there are then little miniature wards inside those, which I also don't know exactly, but they are in the top 3%. So we have that kind of paradox, and that's sort of something I think we need to look at as a city and work out how we balance that a bit better.
I mean, do you think we've forgotten the skills that we need to work together as a community? Do you think?
I'm not sure we've forgotten them. I think the way that society is structured now sometimes makes it very difficult. We all live much further away from our families. Well, not all of us do, actually. That's not true. There are some people in Bristol who still have very close family links. But I think there are structures in society which make it more difficult. So if you are actually poor and you've got bad housing and you've got bad health and you've not got good education, I think it's quite difficult then to work out how you work together, because you haven't got the resources. And that's one of the issues that we're looking at, is how do you resource yourselves and each other?
Yeah.
What is it that actually helps that?
Okay. So what can people do if they're interested in this week and this particular launch? Can anybody sort of come along and check it out or get involved?
Anyone can come along. It's 12 to 2, lunchtime, free lunch, free event at the Cathedral at the bottom of Park Street on Monday the 22nd of March. Anyone can come to that, the more the merrier.
Okay.
We'll be trying to collect ideas and thoughts that people have, perceptions that people have. If they want to know more about the year, they can contact us at the Pierian Centre. We've got a website where all the details are, which is www.pieriancentre.com.
Hey, there we go. Came pre-prepared with the website. You'd be amazed how many people don't.
And Pierian is spelt P-I-E-R-I-A-N.
Okay, excellent. Well, June Burrow, thank you very much. And, you know, what do you think is the best thing that you think will have happened as a result of this by sort of February 2011, do you think?
My hope is that by being part of an event that's part of the Bristol Partnership, that all the organisations and this Working Together for Positive Change will become part of how we work forward into 2020. Into a city which has really started to deal with some of these issues.
Great. Mm. Thank you very much. And just a reminder, that's at the Cathedral on the 22nd of March from 12 till 2.
Thank you.
Well, our Anthea Page went along to the Arnolfini, or rather I should say above the Arnolfini, on the 15th of February last month. And there was a talk given by Alistair McIntosh, a well-known ecologist, and it was all about engaging the powers. Well, that was the title of it, and it was about communities. How communities have fragmented, how we've become alienated from each other, how privatisation of land could be a cause of that, and how accessing the right to land can be a solution.
Hello, I'm Alistair McIntosh, and I've come down today from Scotland.
Could you tell us about your books?
Yes, I've got three books. The best-known one is Soil and Soul, which is a book about the struggle we had in Scotland to bring about land reform legislation and also to stop a multinational company from destroying a mountain in a national scenic area to turn it into a roadstone. And then last year I produced two books, of which the major one is called Hell and High Water, Climate Change, Hope and the Human Condition, and the other one is called Rekindling Community, which is one of the Schumacher briefings. I've got all three of them this evening, but I think the main focus this evening is going to be on how do we live with the probable consequences of climate change, not so much in the sense of all the ordinary things that we might do, like recycling and cutting back on transport and so on, but getting to the deeper levels, getting to the level of how what it means to be a human being in a way that helps us to find our fulfillment in life, not from excessive consumerism, which helps drive climate change, but from seeking deeper satisfaction in our relationships and in our inner life. In a word, the work that builds community with one another, within ourselves, and with the environment that we're part of.
So do you think when people become more affluent, the community spirit goes, in a sense?
You know, I grew up on the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland, and in the 1960s, when I was a boy, we would all wander into each other's houses. If somebody was stuck for something, the neighbours would help them out and so on. There was no TV, so people told stories to each other. There was tremendous richness of people, a richness of relationship. And it's incredible how that has changed because of affluence, just exactly as you say. To give you an example, when I was a boy, if I was coming home from town, as often as not, I would hitch it rather than get the bus, because you'd never have to wait long to get a lift. A few years ago, I was up on the island, and I'd grown a beard. You know us ecologist types, we've got to have somewhere for the bird's nest.
It's a very nice beard.
Thank you. And so people didn't recognise who I was, and so I could have been anybody, and I was hitching along. Well, do you know, I walked 10 miles and didn't get a lift. And I think what was going on was two things. One is that in this day and age, nobody's quite so sure who they'd be picking up as they once might have been. But the other thing that was so obvious walking along the road is that people were going by at such incredible speed. In the past, they would have gone past at 30 or 40 miles an hour, and they'd kind of have a chance to have a look at you before they stopped and picked you up. And now they were all going past at 60 miles an hour, and there'd be convoys of them, vroom, vroom, vroom. And so, as a consequence of that affluence, which has many plus sides, let's not deny that, but as a consequence of it, the strength of community, the ethic of people looking out for and helping one another had been partly lost.
So do you think people think that affluence brings happiness? But in a lot of the time, people can get very depressed because they get more isolated.
Well, that's it, you see. And I mean, you ask, do people think that affluence brings happiness? I bet if you were to ask your listeners, very few of them would say yes to that question, unless they really are hard-pressed, unless they're seriously in debt, in which case it is a burning issue in their lives. Once people get to a level where they're kind of breaking even in their finances, I think a lot of human beings, probably a majority of human beings, know that money can't buy you love. And that the more money you have, in a sense, the more it cuts you off from relationship with people, until one of the things you see with very wealthy people is that their social reality is distorted, because everybody's sort of buzzing around them, trying to be nice and trying to be polite and hoping some crumbs might fall from the table. And it literally distorts how they experience reality. So I think we all need money up to a level of sufficiency. We all need the products that we consume up to a level of dignified sufficiency. But when we start going beyond that into surplus, into excess, then something inside us starts corrupting and we lose the plot as to what it means to be a human being.
So do you think there's any hope that we can return to that sort of idyllic way of life, say that was in the 50s?
Well, I don't think they were talking about being able to put back the clock to how it was in the 50s or when I was a boy or something like that. But I think we can look forward. We can say, what was it about the way we lived then that we can reintegrate into our lives now? And basically, what it was about then is that in those days, in the post-Second World War years, people had to live in a frugal manner and find the fruits, find the benefits of doing that. The question now is whether we want to do that as a matter of choice. And that is the fundamental question. You know, do you or I use the gifts we have been given simply to serve ourselves and progress in our careers and make ourselves ever richer and so on? Or do we reach a certain point when we say, okay, been there, done that, I've proven that I can wash my face in life, now let me use my energies for the common good? And you know, one of the things that gives me hope is that I see a lot of people starting to think like that, even people in corporations and so on, who think, I don't need to make any more money. What can we do now to green up what we're doing, to make things better for our employees and the communities we're living in? And I think that that's where hope for the future lies.
Do you think affluence brings boredom?
Oh, what a wonderful question to ask, because I've just been reviewing a book called The Junior Officers Reading Club by Patrick Hennessy. And it's a fascinating book because it's a story of a young British soldier. He describes himself as one of the smart-assed Thatcherite kids of the 80s, who was bored at university, so he joins the army. He's bored in the army until they start shooting people in Afghanistan. And then in the end, you get the sense that he even gets bored of shooting at people. And he comes back to Britain, and what are they playing at the party? But they're playing Bunny and the Echo Men, and he just can't relate to it. In other words, he is profoundly tripped up as a human being by never having got to grips with boredom. Now, I think that boredom is a spiritual disease. It's a very common spiritual disease. We try to resolve it in many ways. Affluence is one of the ways. Shop until you drop. Retail therapy, that kind of stuff. We try to resolve it through pornography, through violence, war, etc. And I really think we have got to get to grips with it and say that when we feel bored in our outer life, there is a blockage in the flow of our inner lives. In other words, it is an issue that is psychological, and personally, I would make no bones about it. Whatever your religion or whether you have no religion at all, it's also a spiritual question. It's about how you free up the flow of what gives life, the flow of what allows love to manifest between us and to build community, and then you won't feel bored.
That was Alistair McIntosh, the ecologist there, giving a discussion about communities and accessing the right to land, and that took place at the Arnolfini on the 15th of February. And the man was introduced by a gentleman named Peter Bruce, who's sitting opposite me in the studio right now. Hello.
Hello.
We were having a discussion about this just before we came on. We've decided you're a social entrepreneur. You didn't really have a fixed title as such, but what is your interest in ecology and Alistair McIntosh, and how are you there?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we've got lots of changes we need to face in society with all the climate change, the financial changes that are taking place, lots of ways in which people will have to look differently at the world. And engaging Alistair in that talk was to help people understand the sorts of changes that can go on and what you can achieve out to the back end in terms of much better way of life for all sorts of different areas of land or ways people live.
So if you're satisfied with the status quo, living in sort of Bristol, what is your vision of what you want to have changed? How would a society be better for you to be sort of satisfied that?
Yeah, I mean, a social entrepreneur is a strange term, but it's really about sort of enterprise and business, but in a social setting with communities, looking at how we can improve access to things and also things that are going to projects which are going to deliver improvements to that community's way of living. And what we're particularly trying to look at currently is farming, getting people to be able to have access to vegetables that are locally grown, organic basis, at a price which is comparable with what's in the shops. And today we can deliver that on a local basis, and people can then know where their food comes from without it travelling thousands of miles, being packaged up in all sorts of ways, mistreated, and got to them at a quite expensive approach through high carbon footprints.
Okay, I mean, we have a lot of allotments all over Bristol, and we also have an awful lot of Tesco's opening, which seems to be doing very well. So that would rather say maybe people quite like just going to the supermarket. So what is stopping people from growing their own vegetables currently, do you think? What's lacking?
Well, there is a shortage of land for allotments, and there's quite a list waiting for to get access to allotments. Okay. This is something which is a bit different. This is going up a next level to say, for the people who don't want to actually do their own vegetable growing, but still have an interest in actually getting good quality veg at a reasonable price, we can group together, we can employ some growers, and there's several in North Bristol who are interested in setting up a growers cooperative to actually sort of produce them with a quality edge to it, very professionally. And also they can then sort of come along and see where it's grown, help on work days, get involved a bit, understand a bit more about where food comes from.
Okay, so now I'm saying
kids down.
Now I'm saying where cooperative members employ growers, and then you need land to do that. And now I'm saying where your role as a social entrepreneur and running all this is beginning to take shape. So where is this? Have you found anywhere for a community farm?
Well, in North Bristol, there isn't such a thing today. So it used to be an area rich in market gardens all across up the M32 as you drive into Bristol, mm-hmm. all of that area, and right out around Winterbourne. There's very good grade one agricultural land there. And 30 years ago, it was blossoming with vegetables. That's all gone with the new supply chains that feed the supermarkets. So we're trying to get that back into cultivation again, and to set up lots of these community farms serving people from some Werburgs right out to Winterbourne and Stoke Gifford and Bradley Stoke.
Okay, so what contacts have you managed to make with sort of local community groups that might have expressed might be interested in this sort of thing? How are you reaching out to people?
Well, the aim is to really get members who actually want to take the veg. They're the key to it, because it's providing a service to them, and through that creating and generating a community spirit through that. So there are lots of people who have expressed an interest, and I've got lists of those. We've held some public meetings. What we're looking for now is some land to actually put the farm onto, and we just need a couple of acres of good agricultural land suitable for market gardens. So if anybody out there has or knows somewhere, then do get back in touch, and then we can get going this year, which would be great.
Okay, I'm expecting the answer to this might be somewhat pessimistic, but obviously we've got an election coming up. We've got lots of parties vying with the public for things going to do. Have you seen sustainable development in any of their manifestos? Anything promising?
Yeah, I think everybody is sort of talking about it, but everybody is finding difficulties of getting the next step forward to changing our lives to be more sustainable. And that's where this community farm is doing it from a bottom level up, to say, well, we can't wait for all of that adjustment to the markets and to mm-hmm. the pricing and everything else to take account of these externalities. Let's just go in and start bottom up with zero carbon food.
Indeed, there are local people who are trying it already. A certain Mark Boyle is trying to live without money for an entire year and is trying to make waves in the local and national press. We've got the Tesco's, the proposed site for a Tesco's on Stokes Croft has been taken over, and that is now inhabited by squatters, so Tesco's are not allowed in. What do you want to really see 1 year from now? How far do you hope to have progressed with your vision to set up a community farm, like having the land?
Well, yeah, if we've been able to set up this year, then we'll have people who are sort of living with better diets and obviously sort of getting closer to land, hopefully feeling better about their lives and well-being.
How much land are you going to need?
It's just a couple of acres will feed 50 families.
50 families, okay.
And then sort of the aim is to repeat that model as we grow into sort of different communities as well.
Okay, how do you think, can you really compete with supermarkets on this kind of thing?
The costs of oil and all the packaging and all the transport and processing and everything else of food today is so huge in those huge supply chains that it really puts the cost up quite considerably. So we can employ extra people on the land working in much more humane and sort of local levels, but pay them a decent rate to actually create that vegetables locally for us and get directly to the consumer. So there's no middlemen.
Okay. So do you have a sort of an official name for your sort of community farm project yet?
Well, currently it's sort of based around the Winterbourne area. So Winterbourne Community Farm is what I've been marketing. But there's no reason why people from other communities and people I know in Bradley Stoke has signed up and Stoke Gifford. People down as far as St Werburgh's are interested, and we're looking to sort of bring all of those together. And the more people we have, the more hopefully we can set up.
Brilliant. Okay. Do you have a web presence at all? How can people get in touch with you if they're interested?
We're just setting up a website, wcf.btik.com.
So that once again?
wcf.btik.com.
Okay.
But it may be best to get in touch with me on peter.bruce@gmail.com.
Okay, peter.bruce@gmail.com. Well, Peter Bruce, thank you very much for coming in. And I understand you're undertaking MSc in sustainable development as well. So best of luck with that and with your project. And we hope to hear from how you're getting on in the future.
Thank you. It's lovely.
The privatisation of land, or as it's usually known, enclosure, has been going on since 1235 in the reign of Henry III. It's notoriously lucrative, and some people believe was the cause of the English Civil War in the mid-17th century. And I'd like to introduce our very own Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
So have you come across exactly the date 1235? What happened?
Well, this was the date of the very first statute in the statute book. So we're very used now to the government through the House of Lords and the House of Commons passing laws. They're known as statutes. But this was the first one. Yes, the earliest one in the statute book. It was issued after a meeting of the Great Council at Merton Priory in Surrey in 1235. and it upheld the right of a lord of the manor to enclose common land. And most importantly, this was in contradiction of canon law. So at the time, the church had its own courts, and canon law said that there was no way that the land could be privatised because the church saw the land as belonging to God, and we were just simply tenants on the land. Mm. And the idea that a landowner, someone could completely own land, was anathema. Very much in a similar way to the way when colonisers arrived in the Americas, that the American Indians had no concept of ownership of land. It was the same here, up until 1235.
Okay, we'll be discussing enclosure with local historian Barb Drummond in a moment. But a pause from Tony for a moment for the first one of the most famous poems in the English language about enclosure. It's called The Moors by John Clare.
Far spread the money ground, a level scene bespread with rush and one eternal green that never felt the rage of blundering plough, though centuries wreathed spring's blossoms on its brow. Still meeting plains that stretch them far away in unchecked shadows of green, brown and grey. Unbounded freedom ruled the wandering scene, nor fence of ownership crept in between to hide the prospect of the following eye. Its only bondage was the circling sky. One mighty flat, undwarfed by bush and tree, sprayed its faint shadow of immensity and lost itself, which seemed to eke its bounds in the blue mist the horizon's edge surrounds. Now this sweet vision of my boyish hours, free as spring clouds and wild as summer flowers, is faded all, a hope that blossomed free and hath been once, no more shall ever be. Enclosure came and trampled on the grave of labour's rights and left the poor a slave. A memory's pride e'er went to wealth did bow, is both the shadow and the substance now. The sheep and cows were free to range as then, where change might prompt nor felt the bonds of men. Cows went and came with evening morn and night, to the wild pasture or as the common right. And sheep, unfolded with the rising sun, heard the swains shout and felt their freedom won, tracked the red fallow field and heath and plain, then met the brook and drank and roamed again. The brook that dribbled on as clear as glass, beneath the roots they hid among the grass, while the glad shepherd traced their tracks along, free as the lark and happy as her song. But now all's fled, and flats of many a dye that seemed to lengthen with the following eye. Moors, losing the sight, far smooth and bleak, where swooped the plover in its pleasure free, are vanished now with commons wild and gay, as poets' visions of life's early day. Mulberry bushes where the boy would run to fill his hands with fruit are grubbed and done, and hedgerow briars, flower lovers overjoyed, came and got flower pots. These are all destroyed. And sky-bound morays in mangled garbs are left, like mighty giants of their limbs bereft. Fence now meets fence in owner's little bounds of field and meadow large as garden grounds, in little parcels, little minds to please, with men and flocks imprisoned, ill at ease. Each little path that led its pleasant way, as sweet as morning, leading night astray, where little flowers bloomed round a varied host that travel felt delighted to be lost. Nor grudged the steps that had taken in vain, when right roads traced his journeys and again. Nay, on a broken tree he'd sit a while, to see the morays and fields and meadow smile. Sometimes with cowslips smothered, then all white with daisies, then the summer's splendid sight of cornfields crimson, o'er the headache bloomed, like splendid armies for the battle plumed. He gazed with them with wild fancy's eye, as fallen landscapes from an evening sky. These paths are stopped, the rude Philistine's thrall is laid upon them and destroyed them all. Each little tyrant with his little sign shows where man claims earth glows no more divine. But paths to freedom and to childhood dear, a board sticks up to notice no road here. And on the tree with ivy overhung, the hated sign by vulgar taste is hung, as though the very birds should learn to know when they go they must no further go. This, with the poor, scared freedom bade goodbye, and much they feel it in the smothered sigh. And birds and trees and flowers without a name all sighed when lawless law's enclosure came, and dreams of plunder in such rebel schemes have found too truly that they were but dreams.
And thank you very much to Trevor Carter for his excellent reading skills, and that was The Moors by John Clare.
Yes, thanks John, and thanks Trevor. And now on to our discussion about Enclosure, with me, Tony Gosling, and Barb Drummond. Barb, what happened when land was enclosed?
There were lots of things that happened. One of the first things was that it generated a lot of work locally building fences, so the local people thought that they were getting a better deal. And then once the fences were built, they were pretty much laid off, so they had to find somewhere else to go. So they either went to the cities or they emigrated or whatever. They just had to go.
Now, in England, I know this was taking place before the English Civil War, piecemeal, bit by bit, but it accelerated after the Civil War. The other thing was that people used to get a bit of compensation, didn't they? Not just a little bit of work. One of the things I came across with one of the enclosures in Oxfordshire was that everybody that lost their land and lost their home was offered in exchange a barrel of beer.
I have no idea. I think one of the things is that every area was different, every lord of the manor was different. I don't think there was any set rules. So, you know,
people do sometimes talk about the Enclosure Act, don't they? I've heard people saying that to me, the Enclosure Act. Well, actually, what it happened was piecemeal right across the country.
Each enclosure had to have an act.
Yeah.
So it was a whole series of parliamentary acts.
And even though it was called the House of Commons, of course, it was a landowner's parliament because you had to own at least, I think, something like 2 or 3 acres of land to vote, even. So it was really about sort of private property rights. Anyway... The benefits were called, it was called improvement, agricultural improvement, and that was essentially, this is a sort of in the 1500s and 1600s, what led up to the agricultural revolution. So do you think that there were some real positive sides to enclosure?
There were. The traditional system of farming was incredibly wasteful because everyone had an equal strip of land that they farmed, but there was space between each strip, and they would plough one strip. There was arable. There were three different types of land. So there was a lot of waste land in between them, and people were only allowed to plough a set strip. And if they went over that, that caused friction. So there were I don't know how many, but there were cases where the local people actually asked for enclosure because they were absolutely fed up with arguing over their strips of land and fighting with their neighbours.
Another thing I remember reading about was the way that your standing in the village was very much based on the condition you left your allotment in. I mean, essentially, that's what the strip field system was, little allotments, lots and lots of them. And, you know, some people would leave their allotments in a good condition for the next year, for someone taking it over from the next year, and other people would leave them in a bad condition. And if you were well known as someone who left your allotment in a grotty condition, you didn't have much standing in the village.
Well, that would cause arguments.
So, in a way, it was simplifying things to just say, well, you know, you don't have an allotment, you don't have anywhere to grow land anymore, and anyway, there's all these lovely factories in the city for you to go and work in, or in the cities to go and work in. So whilst the factories were there, it was a good thing.
Factories came later. I mean, it does vary, but they didn't go straight from the farms to the cities in that way. The there are a lot of famines. I mean, one of the things I'm working on at the moment is hunger. And you've got instances with around 1600 where Bristol was really taking a hammering with the food. They were in famine years. They would go, they would be importing food from Worcester. They'd be bringing in grain from Danzig, from Ireland. And then in other years, Ireland and Bristol would be fighting over food coming in from Worcester. So you've got this whole pattern of famines that are coming in. I've read recently that the grain of the poor used to be rye, but in the 18th century it was wheat. Now, wheat is a lot more sensitive, it's a lot harder to grow, and it leaches the soil of nutrients. So if you've got a change from that means that you're going to get a lot more famines as well. So there's a whole lot of things in terms of land management that was going on, which is possibly part of the Reformation and the Civil War, that probably the knowledge in how to manage the land had been lost.
Well, there were big changes going on, certainly in the countryside, and every village was changing its shape as it got enclosed. Some of them had rebellions, you know, where the local people would simply not accept it and fight against the enclosure, and usually eventually it may be even two or three attempts to enclose the land and then finally it would be done. But there were two sides to the coin, at least as I see it. One was the idea of depopulation, right? So mm-hmm. the idea that the countryside was being depopulated. Some place like Wiltshire, you can go through in the car or the train now and see hardly anybody living around Wiltshire because it's all been turned over to sheep. And, of course, that was the right kind of thing for that sort of land. But depopulation as against improvement in agriculture, what do you think was the most important of those two?
Well, the thing is that the agricultural revolution came quite late. There's all kinds of cycles going on, that there was money coming in from the colonies which made that the cities were a lot wealthier so that you could earn more money going into the city, so that some people were driven off the land, but some of them actually left the land to get better wages and better conditions. So there's pushes and pulls there. In the cities, there was just more opportunity for their children, more advancement. They weren't kept enthralled to the lord of the manor. There's all kinds of things going on. And they could learn new skills because there were new industries happening. But the factories came later. Factories are more sort of, I mean, it's just really, everywhere is different.
But I think it's probably true to say that the Industrial Revolution couldn't have happened if there hadn't been a revolution in agriculture.
I think the Industrial Revolution, it varies in terms of the regions. The nominal date for the Industrial Revolution is 1750, and as far as I can tell, the Agricultural Revolution didn't start till after that. So it was the need to feed the people in the cities that kick-started the Agricultural Revolution rather than the other way around.
The other thing is that certainly by my reading of it, the English Civil War was a big turning point because the enclosures up until the English Civil War were very contentious, tended to be more contentious, and it happened very slowly, whereas in the time after the Civil War, that is in the 1660s, 70s and 80s, you see far more enclosure taking place. But then that wouldn't surprise most people because the Civil War was really a battle between the feudal classes and the merchant classes, and the merchants were the ones that were doing most of the actual enclosing for financial reasons.
You just had complete disruption, and you had, for a long time, you'd lost that notion that the ordinary people were enthralled to the landlord, so that they would be more likely to rise up. They were being encouraged to think for themselves, so they were more likely to rebel and to actually start staking their claims on what they believed was their own, which wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the Civil War.
Well, one of the things that the enclosers often said was that they were fed up with the peasants because they would spend so much of their time sitting around doing nothing. But then, of course, one of the good things from anyone's point of view in those days was that actually people in those days had much more leisure time. So do you think it's still relevant today, enclosure?
Well, I was one of the campaigners to save Castle Park, so I would have to say yes. I think that the battle for urban space is kind of an invisible one because there's the government selling off playing fields and things like that. We're losing open spaces and nobody's really noticing it anymore. And I think that's a real tragedy because we do need open space.
Well, we just heard, for example, the city council trying to sell off this farm out in Portishead. which was traditionally those farms were a way for ordinary people to lease a farm and get into farming through kind of small holding type activity and get into farming. Now it seems that it's all going in the opposite direction, where only the big farms are surviving and no folk from the city really can have a chance to get into it. It's consolidation of big farms only. Anyway, thanks ever so much for joining us on Dialect Today and talking about enclosure, Bob.
You're welcome.
And do you want to just plug any of your books that have looked at enclosure or something that's coming up?
I'm about to release a book in about a week's time called Cats in Conduits. It's a history of drinking water in Bristol, and there'll be another one on hunger coming up after that.
Of course, that's another common, isn't it? Water.
Yes.
Thanks.
It's now time for the honeyed tones of actor Malcolm Greaves to read another episode of Hedge Trimmings.
A shadow from the past. The mists of memory roll aside for a while, and this is what I see. A small boy and an old dairyman are feeding the pigs. The mixing tub contains separated milk, upon which is floating barley meal, like a miniature seaside. They proceed to mix the contents, the dairyman using a thick pole, whilst the small boy is busy with a broom handle. It is great fun. The sticks go quite slowly through the layer of meal, and they move with a sudden rush to the bottom of the tub when they reach the liquid beneath. Sometimes they go down with a loud plop, and gobbets of meal fly everywhere. Alas for clean pinafores. And all the time there are excited squeals and grunts of impatient anticipation from the adjoining pigsties. The mixing finished, the movable boar at the back of the sty is bolted in front of the trough to keep the pigs back while the trough is filled with their food. While the dairyman is bringing the food in buckets from the mixing house, the small boy sits on the rail above the trough and whacks at the impatient pigs with a switch. How they squeal and fight with one another. And there you have the scene. A small boy, thoroughly dirty but indescribably happy, seated on a rail above a horde of clamouring, disgustful swine. In the dim background, the old dairyman moving about, filling the trough, and outside the small boy's spaniel, anxiously awaiting the return of his diminutive overlord, and wondering what all the noise is about. For the air is filled with noise. Noise incessant. Shrill, pleading squeals, defiant squeals, grunts and snorts of impatience and exasperation, the banging and rattling of the offending barrier, the clank of the buckets, and the slow, smooth, sogging guggle of the meal being poured into the trough. Suddenly, in the midst of all this cacophony, the board is pulled back, bolted into position behind the trough, and then it is as though each pig suddenly shut off steam. For a silence descends which can almost be felt. Whilst the pigs feed, the dairyman and his assistant gaze lovingly at them. There is something very soothing about watching pigs feed. They are so very happy. Six or seven broad backs in line touching one another. Six or seven tails curling and uncurling in ecstasy, and the same number of mouths gobbling for dear life. It is at these moments that the small assistant also imbibes something, and the something is that intangible farming knowledge which he will never find in textbooks.
"Doing well, E.B.," says his mentor. "How long before we kill them, Dairyman?" asks the bloodthirsty pupil.
"Well, Maester says we be the bacon, thee's lot, so that'll mean we'll give them about 90. What should you call the saddlebackton?"
The small assistant has not the least idea, but being in his own estimation a master farmer, he hazards a guess at 60.
It would never do to let his companion think that he knew nothing about it. "Now, if you was buying they pigs, and you could buy them at 60, you'd do well, for I low thick fellow be nigh on 8.
"But when shall we kill them?"
"Oh, in about a fortnight, I low. I'll let 'ee know when 'tis, 'cause we shall want your help. Now you best go. I can hear Emily a-calling for 'ee."
Reluctantly, the future slayer of pigs obeys his nursemaid's call and descends from his high estate to the realm of woman's dominion, a rule he resents more strongly year by year. The killing of the pigs brings other characters upon the scene, the chief being that admirable Crichton, one Bill Noakes. He is the farm's jack of all trades, whose manifold duties include the scientific slaughter of the pigs. The small boy hates and respects him. He administers sudden and just punishment for even so trivial an offence as practising one's catapult on the fowls. He has what may be termed the all-seeing eye. No deviation from the straight and narrow path of dull righteousness is possible around the farm if Bill is anywhere about. From the depths of the buildings will come a bellow.
"Aye, you young limb, get down off'n thick roof or I'll twap 'ee smartish."
The sound of that voice is enough. A small pinafored shape scrambles swiftly down and flees from the certain wrath to come. Just before 10 o'clock on the morning of the slaughter, the executioners gather. The old dairyman carries to the scene of operations all the various necessaries, a long, low stool, a bucket or two, and several pitchers of clean, dry wheat straw. Bill Noakes arrives in more or less correct butcher's regalia. From some source or other, he has obtained a blue apron. A steel is girt about his waist. In one hand he holds a piece of oilstone, and in the other an old but very sharp knife. He does not really need the apron at all, nor even the steel. He is perfectly capable of sticking pigs in any garb, even in his nightshirt, but a blue apron looks more professional, and Bill is nothing, if not correct.
"Where's Charmer?" he asks the dairyman as he wets his knife lovingly against the stone. "Mucking out the cowpen. He'll be here in a minute or two."
But men of Bill's calibre wait no Charmer's pleasure. He crosses the yard to the cowhouse, in which a gawky youth named Blake is leisurely cleaning out the manure.
"Best thee took root in the yard, Charmer. Come on, I be ready."
Charmer Blake leaves his wheelbarrow and follows the great man back to the piggeries. But where is that small boy who was so anxious to be an active participant in the coming slaughter? Doesn't he know that Der Tag has arrived? Of course he does. But there is a little matter of business still unsettled betwixt him and Bill. A day or two ago, he was nearly caught red-handed. Fishing from the ducks from the top of the cowyard wall with a worm on an eel hook. Were he to appear this morning until the psychological moment, in all probability, Bill would send him home as a punishment. When that moment arrives, he will be there all right. He escaped from his nursemaid's control soon after breakfast, since when he is hidden in a yew tree in the shrubbery outside the farmhouse. From this lofty, secret perch, he obtains a bird's eye view of all the farm buildings, and he is well aware of all that has taken place. He watches Bill and Charmer go across the yard. He sees Bill take a piece of thin, strong cord and make the required loop. Even when Bill
disappears into the victim's sty. The small watcher knows exactly what is taking place. In fancy, he can see the loop placed loosely around the pig's snout, the beak biting the lower curve of it, and then Bill pulling the noose tight around its upper jaw. There is a snort, a squeal and a bustle. "Open the door, Charmer, look alive," says Bill. The door opens and closes quickly in a struggling procession consisting of Bill, Charmer, the dairyman and the pig, makes its drunken way along the pathway and disappears through a door into the rickyard. As it vanishes, it gains another adherent, for grasping firmly the tail of the pig is a small boy in a dirty pinafore. The psychological moment has arrived.
And that was Head Trimmings there by A.G. Street and read by Malcolm Greaves. And moving on to Arty Things once again with Mr. Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hello.
Hello again, John.
And the Bard of Dialect Radio. What's been happening in your week?
What's been happening? Oh, it's been very dramatic, but you don't want to know all about my personal dramas, I'm sure.
Oh, we can't. Well, you can't say that. You can't say it's very dramatic and then deny us all knowledge.
Well, I've lost my day job.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but don't worry about that, because I've got more time to devote to more important things.
Ah, silver linings. Silver linings. Excellent. More poems of dialect. What have you got this week?
Well, I'm thinking about the themes of money, corruption, the election and exasperation.
Okay.
So those are the themes I've tried to tie together
in
this little summary. It's called Round and Round. The money rattles round and round while we are ground into the ground. The dollar, yen and mighty pound make us aggravated. The bankers take their profits out, we are ripped off, and so we doubt what this strange system is about. Is it overrated? Nobody knows quite what to do. The government don't have a clue. They're as confused as me and you. That is why I sound off. Our money should be safe and sound. My patience is now overwound. We have lost more than we have found. So I'm feeling browned off. There is nowhere that we can turn. The more we work, the less we earn. While bankers still have cash to burn and spend on the election. Should we make cuts or should we spend? Who has some money they can lend? What can help us in the end? Send in your suggestion.
Well, thank you very much, and much commiserations on your lack of jobbage.
Yes.
And hopefully...
If anyone out there has a job offer for me...
Okay, get in touch with Dialect
Radio.
Is there anything you would particularly like to plug?
Well, we do have another Lansdowne Cabaret coming up next month.
Okay.
The 9th and 10th of April at the Lansdowne Pub, Clifton Road. Same time, same price, so it's... 8:15 start, only £7 for the greatest show in town, entertainment on all fronts. Phone me if you'd like to make reservations on 0117-966-5514. The magnificent Matt Pang, the enduring barminess of the Bard of Windmill Hill, and much, much more.
What an advertising expert, Mr. Windmill Hill there. It's time for the What's On Guide. Time to welcome the man in black. Here he is with his Iron Maiden t-shirt and a gold ring. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting on Wednesday, 17th of March, at Glamour of the Kill. We'll be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £6.50 in advance. On to Thursday, 18th of March, Eureka Machines will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On Friday 19th of March, the international blues rock guitarist Larry Miller will be performing at the Tunnels at Bristol and Exeter Mews in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £9 in advance and £11 on the door. Also on 19th of March, the Whitesnake tribute group Snakebite will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £7 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I pay tribute to the great local musician Fred Wedlock, who passed away on 4th of March 2010, aged 67. This is from the album titled The Complete Folker and Frolics Albums, and is the track Wild Rover.
I've been a wild rover for many's the year, and I've spent all my money on weed.
promised heal and heal. But now I'm returning with gold in great store. I never will play a wife no more. Right, boys, that's a noisy rabbit.
That was Fred Wedlock with the track Wild Rover from the album titled The Complete Folker and Frolics Albums. For more information on him, check out www.fredwedlock.com. Moving on to Saturday 20th of March in Cabaret Abattoir, we'll be performing at the Tunnels at Bristol and Exeter Mews in Bristol. Expect burlesque dancers and music from Pariah Circus, The Whores and headliners Nemhain. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £7 in advance, £8 on the door before 10pm and £9 after 10pm. Finally, on Sunday 21st of March, Kit Morgan, Stuart Gordon and Keith Warmington will all be performing at the Carnation Tap in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts around 4pm and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And just a reminder, of course, Larry Miller coming up soon at the Tunnels. He's an insanely good guitarist, so if you don't know who he is, go and check him out. Well, that's all for this week's radio show. Time's up already. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. Hello to Elaine Jerkins, a loyal listener. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Or you can search for Dialect Radio on iTunes, and we're also on Twitter. If you're a Twittery sort of person, you can follow us there. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. We upload the show there. And if you're outside Bristol, you can listen to BCFM on their website, bcfm.org.uk. Thank you to our studio guests Barb Drummond, Peter Bruce, June Burrow from the Perian Centre, and Trevor Carter. And the reporters this week were Anthea and Tony. Studio production by this week was by Johnny Royden and Andy Gordon, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you're listening and you'd like to come along, just see what we do in reporting, engineering, or just seeing the show being recorded, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol. And the number for them is 0117 989 7733. And you can find them on the web, bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Well, that was Dialects, and I'm John Peters Collins, wishing you a very good week from all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for your company. Until next week, goodbye. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectsradio.co.uk.